So what I'd like to ask you to do is to think back to a time in your life where you were dealing with something that was just kind of overwhelming. You know, it might have been a health issue, might have been a challenge with a job, maybe you were in a really difficult relationship, potentially a dangerous relationship. And when you're in those, it's kind of hard to know what to do, that we find ourselves at times in experiences where we just can't figure out a way out. In fact, we not only not even sure what to do, we're not even sure there's something that we can do. And for some of you, that might not even be a memory. For some of you, that might be something you're experiencing right now. So what do we do in times like that? Those are incredibly challenging times in our lives. And sometimes what happens is that, you know, as we experience these things and we reach out to those around us, I mean, first of all, we take that very difficult step of talking to someone else and trusting them with that. And sometimes people give us helpful direction, helpful advice. Sometimes they recognize the best thing to do is just listen. But sometimes well-meaning people trying to be helpful but not really sure what to say, when you tell them what you're having trouble with, they'll say something like, well, you know, you just need to have a little faith. You just got to believe. You just got to believe it's going to be okay. And when that happened, you're like, I do believe. I do have faith. And I'm still scared. And it's still not going well. Or maybe you're even saying, you know, I'm having trouble believing. And maybe that person's well-meaning intentions actually gave you little comfort. That although faith is important, we live in the real world. And in the real world, just having faith isn't enough. I mean, if you lose your job and you sit around watching Netflix having faith that you're going to find one, that's probably not going to work. Right? That you might need to go out and look for a new job. You might even need to upskill, right? Actually take, you know, training or classes online. Instead of watching Netflix, learn to be a computer programmer or learn how to fix something. Right? That in real life, faith is really important, but what we do also matters. In fact, I would argue, and in fact, for the next half hour, I'm going to argue that there are three key things that we should do when we're in these situations. When you find yourself in a situation where it just seems like, I don't know what I should do. As we'll see, I believe that God actually lays out a very clear plan for us, that when we're in a difficult situation where we're trying to beat the odds, in other words, it feels like there's really no good way forward, that God shows us that there are three things we need to embrace. Facts, faith, and a willingness to fight. And when I say a willingness to fight, I want to be clear. I'm not talking about creating trouble or anything. I'm talking about a willingness to do the work that needs to be done. Because if we look about the first one, like looking at the facts, one of the things that often happens to us in difficult times is that the reality of our situation can seem overwhelming. And in overwhelming situations, sometimes we'll kind of say, well, I don't want to know all the details. You know, I know a person who actually had clearly problematic medical symptoms. And their solution was, as long as I don't go to the doctor, I won't know. Right? And we laugh, but we laugh because we know we kind of think it sometimes, right? So we have to have reality or be realistic about our situation. And the thing is that as we try to do that, we want to also identify a couple things. Because some things in our lives are just out of our control. And we need to understand what those things are that are out of our control. Because in cases of things being out of our control, we do kind of have to surrender those to God. But it rarely is every single thing out of our control. Using my example of the person who lost their job. I mean, if their company was bought by some private equity company who downsized automatically 20% because some MBA course says just downsized by 20%, right? You can't control that. But if your skills are not what you need to get a new job, the part you can control is to increase your skills, sort of thing. So identifying what you can control and what you can't. So those are key facts. And as we go through this, we do want to hold on to our faith, right? We do want to trust that that God is with us. Because I understand that sometimes when things are really dark, it feels like he's not. And you wonder kind of why it's happening and where is God in this? And it is completely okay to ask those questions. But we want to recognize that he is in it with us. And he cares about your pain. He cares about what you're going through. And sometimes one of the most difficult things that we deal with is that we find ourselves in a situation where we start to realize that there is no outcome here that's what I want. There's no version of this that lands where I really want to be. Does that mean God has abandoned you? Or maybe God's going to do something with it. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't struggle. I'm not saying that it should be easy. But what I'm asking you to do with that, when you're doing what you can do, and the outcome is still heading in a place that you didn't really want, trust that God will do something with that. I mean, I know a guy who he was a long-term substance issue person. And ultimately spent 10 years in, not jail, 10 years in prison as a result of things he did because of his habits. That guy now, clean, sober, man of God, faithful follower of Jesus, literally helps hundreds of other men in those same situations. Men who have substance issues, who have spent time in prison, helping them reacclimate to life, helping to build solid foundations of sobriety, providing accountability. Now, I'm certain he did not want to spend 10 years in prison. But I also know that prior to those 10 years in prison, his habits were never changing. That was not an outcome he wanted, but God has done something amazing with it. You know, I don't know what you're struggling with in your life. I don't know what you're dealing with. But I am certain that if you will embrace the reality of what you're dealing with and stick with God, he will do something with it. But then there's that last part, what I've called the fight. And I was really cautious. I struggled with using that word fight because I wrote it really clear. I'm not talking about getting in somebody's face. I'm simply saying, it's funny, fight didn't used to be a dangerous word, but in the modern era, it kind of is. Right? We're just simply saying that we're going to look at what we can do. And we're not going to just look for what's easy. That we're struggling and we're trying to figure out what to do. We're going to look at the parts that we can control and we're going to do what we can. Again, back to the medical diagnosis. Right? You get a medical diagnosis. Do what the doctor tells you, right? Take the medications they tell you to, right? Do whatever meds you have to do, any therapies they tell you. That's your part. That's what you can control. You may not be able to control that you have the disease, but you can control what you do with it. You know, you get a diagnosis of prediabetes or diabetes. And the doctor says that you need to eat a certain way. You need to exercise. Back to the don't just sit there watching Netflix going, I don't know why this is getting so bad. You know, eating a pound of bacon for breakfast going, I don't know why my feet tingle, sort of thing, right? There are things that we can do. You know, and again, more serious things. If you were struggling with, you know, any list of bad, you know, harmful habits, whether it's alcohol, chemical dependency, pornography, gambling, you can't beat those things by yourself. You can't. So you need to seek out help. You need to get with someone who can help you with that. You need to get with people who can walk you through that. And so what I would like to do over this series is actually look at how we apply these things in our life. And what I want to do throughout the series is we actually walk through one of my favorite narratives of the Old Testament, which is the story of Esther. I love the story of Esther. And the story of Esther is this story of a girl who faced unimaginable odds. And she faced difficulty after difficulty after difficulty. And as we'll see, she applies these principles of facing the facts, of maintaining her faith, and continuing to fight. And she gets through them. And the thing is that if you know the story of Esther, you know that Esther is this young orphaned girl who actually lost her parents. We don't know how much earlier. We get the sense it was probably quite a bit earlier. And she's actually rises up from being this orphan girl in a nation that's been conquered to become queen of the conquering nation. And not only does she rise up to become queen, because this is a multi-part thing we're going to go through, and she's going to be queen by the end of today's message. Not to ruin it for you, but some of you probably knew that. She does become queen, she really does. But her problems aren't over. You know, she thought she was facing the most difficult thing she could imagine right from the start, and it was just the beginning. And as the problems continue on, she works with her cousin, a guy named Mordecai. And what we find is that in spite of this incredibly difficult situation that they are in, God does something amazing with it and actually saves all the people of an entire nation. And one of the things that we see here is that one of the things I love about Esther is she is so incredibly real. This is not the story of a superhero. This is a story of a real person with real problems who does extraordinary things because of the fact that she faces her facts, she keeps her faith, and she fights on. Because one of the things that we'll see happen to Esther, something I'm sure happens to us at many times, as she gets overwhelmed with the difficulty of her situations, she's tempted to focus only on her shortcomings. She's tempted to focus only on the things that she cannot do. And she's tempted to overlook her capabilities. And when you're in a difficult situation, in general, does all of your powers and capabilities fly to mind right away? Or is it first, I can't do this, I can't do that, I don't know how to deal with this? Right? That's the temptation you'll experience, but you are capable. If it's happening in your life, you can do something with it. And the narrative of Esther really shows us how to walk through that. So as we look at the story of Esther, this is at a time when the nation of Israel has been conquered. They've been conquered. They're currently being ruled by Persia. They've been conquered for hundreds of years. So Esther basically grows up as a member of this conquered nation. And if you start reading the book of Esther, the first person you meet is not Esther. It's a guy named King. He's known as King Xerxes. He actually has a large number of names. In the Bible, he's usually referred to as King Xerxes. And he's incredibly wealthy. He's incredibly powerful. His reign is huge. We're told that the territories he reigns over are so large, they're divided into 127 different provinces. We know that the people speak a wide variety of languages because anytime he puts a decree out, it has to be translated into a whole bunch of different languages. So he rules over a large number of people, a widespread group of conquered people are under his rule. And how do you think he got his power? He got it the old-fashioned way. He inherited it. That his father was a great warrior, a great leader. His grandfather was. So for two generations ahead of him, they had been doing conquering, and they'd been gathering more and more land. The Persians, I think, were key ones to defeat the Babylonians. So they really grabbed a lot of land. Now, Xerxes, being so proud of all that he has earned, decides one day that he's got to show it off. He says, I'm going to have this huge event. And what I want to do, I want you guys who work for me to take all this beautiful, rich, glorious stuff I have and spread it out for everyone to see for 6 months. So he spreads it out for 6 months for everyone to come see, mostly focused on making sure the nobles come to see it so everyone knows how much he has. But then he decides that, well, as the 6 months is winding down, we should really wind this thing up with a bang. So for the last 7 days, what he decides to do is have a banquet, a 7-day long banquet that's open to both nobles and commoners. So he wants to really show off how rich he is. And to show how rich he is, he says to his servants, I don't want you to put any limits on anybody. People can eat as much as they want. They can drink as much as they want. So a 7-day banquet with unlimited wine, what could possibly go wrong? And just for context, the narrative tells us that the opulence is over the top, that people are literally drinking from gold goblets. There is gold furniture, there are marble pillars, there are marble floors, and the king's just showing all this off. And it seems that the king is kind of getting caught up in how cool it is to get so much attention. And as he's talking with the nobles, we get the sense that maybe the nobles are saying something like, now what I'm about to say isn't in the Bible, but you can kind of infer something similar to this going on, is that as he's talking to them, his nobles are saying that, well, you're great. You've got all this great property. But we've heard your queen is really beautiful. And in that culture, the queen would have largely remained covered, like with veils or something like that. And she's already, at this point, the party's gotten so bad, she's off somewhere else. And they're like, well, hey, you know, your queen is so beautiful. Just how beautiful is she? And of course, you know, as every man who listens to his drunken friends, he makes a great decision. Right? So the narrative tells us that on the seventh day of the feast, when King Xerxes was in high spirits because of the wine, he told the seven eunuchs who attend him to bring Queen Vashti to him with the royal crown on her head. He wanted the nobles and all the other men to gaze on her beauty, for she was very beautiful. So his ego gets the best of him. I'm going to show off my most prized possession. And it's clear that he thinks of her as a possession. Because you want to be clear that although she has the title queen, she has no power. She would certainly have privilege. She would have access. She would certainly have the ability to get to pretty much anything she wants. But she doesn't have any real power. And the king says a couple of things that are really important. He says that he wants her to come out wearing her crown. There's a couple important things about that. One is the king decides who wears the queen's crown. So by saying wearing her crown, he's saying that's my property. That's the marker that she is my property. So he's calling her out effectively as property. He's also calling her out to show her off. Because culturally, what would have happened there normally is as the party wore on, the women of status would have left the room. And then the dancing girls and other things would have come in. And so he's calling his wife into this situation. And he's asking his wife to reveal herself in some way. It might be something as simple as not wearing all the veils she would have. Some commentators think that when he says, come out wearing her crown, he's saying come out wearing only her crown. He's dishonoring her. He's asking her to come out and dishonor herself for his pride. But then she does the unthinkable. If you've heard this story, you know what she does. She says no. And no one says no to the king. King didn't even know what to do with it. The king is literally so upset at someone telling him no, he had to ask his advisors what to do. Like, what do you do? What am I supposed to do here? And so, again, keep in mind that he's been drinking for a week. He's just gotten what he believes is his first no. And he asked the advisors what to do. Now, you might think that the job of a royal advisor is to give good advice. If you have an all-powerful king that can have you executed at one word, what is the job of a royal advisor? Soothe his ego. Keep him happy. Tell him whatever it takes to keep the heat off of you. So the narrative tells us, the advisor answered the king and his nobles, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also every noble and citizen throughout your empire. Women everywhere will begin to despise their husbands when they learn Queen Vashti has refused to appear before the king. Before this day is out, the wives of all the king's nobles throughout Persian media will hear what the queen did and will start treating their husbands the same way. There will be no end to their contempt and anger. Now, what are they doing, right? They're appealing to his ego. King, you are so important. You are so important that every man in this kingdom looks to you to see what you will tolerate, that every woman in the kingdom care so much about your opinion, they look to you to see what's allowable for a wife to do to her husband. King, if you want to really deal with this, this isn't about you. You've got to save the kingdom. You've got to deal with this. And so as they build that up, he buys into it. That you need to deal with this harshly for the good of the kingdom. This isn't about your ego. You're just so important that you just can't let this stand. So the advisor tells the king to write a decree. It says, it should order that Queen Vashti be forever banished from the presence of King Xerxes, And the king should choose another queen more worthy than she. And they actually go on to tell him that what you've done was right. You've done this for the good of the kingdom. The kingdom is now better off because you've made this decision. Now, from the standpoint of the 21st century, you know, we can see this as kind of a bunch of garbage, right? They're just kind of playing to the guy's ego. But it does the job. The king's ego is soothed. But this has very real consequences for Queen Vashti, or formerly Queen Vashti. Because they say that she is forever banished. And if you read Bible commentaries, we're not certain what forever banished means. It's not good. In the best case scenario, she will be sent off to a far part of the palace to never see the king again. Yeah, she'll be taken care of. She'll have food and shelter and so forth, but she'll just kind of live kind of as a widow. It could be a little worse than that. She could be sent off to live with the harems, which would be a huge step down for her. Or it could mean like forever banished, like killed. We don't know. But that's what, for context, that's what the advisors were willing to do to someone to avoid experiencing heat on themselves. But now what happens? Remember, the king was drunk, and eventually he gets sober, and he realizes that I don't have a queen. Now, what's interesting is that he doesn't feel guilty that he doesn't have a queen. He just feels sad. Oh, I don't have a queen. What do I do now? Right, sort of thing. Now, of course, you know, no attendant's going to say, well, you were upset. You know, we did what you wanted. They're not going to say that. So what they say is that, okay, what would make the king really happy? Oh, we have an idea. You should have a contest for your next queen. It'd be kind of like a beauty contest, but worse. Right. That basically, you should actually go out there and, you know, we'll have people go find your next queen. And they'll compete to be your queen. And so, he's like, wow, that's a pretty cool idea. I like that one. So basically, an army of his people head out into this vast empire. And will go around looking for beautiful young women to bring back. To see if they should be queen. And as this goes on, keep in mind that this is not a voluntary situation. If they say you have to come back, you're coming back, right? It isn't like, hey, are you interested in maybe being queen? You know, you've won the sweepstakes, you might be queen, you know, open now sort of thing. No, you've got to go back, right? So it's effectively a kidnapping situation. And this is where we meet the heroes of our story. Because we're told that Esther, we know she's young. She's said to be beautiful of form and face. So she's the kind of woman that they were looking for. And think about Esther is that Esther's had a very difficult life. Right? That she has, again, grown up as part of a nation that has been conquered. It's actually been under multiple conquerors over the past few centuries. The Persians are currently in charge. Her parents have died when she was young. And she's living with her cousin, a guy named Mordecai. So it's basically Mordecai's uncle's daughter. And as far as we can tell, Mordecai cares a great deal for Esther. Not in a romantic way. He cares for her like he would a child. And so while the teams are going out there looking for people, they pick Esther as one of those to come with them. And Esther would not have seen this as good news. That she knows that this very difficult life that she has had is about to get more difficult. Because she knows that for the women who are being taken, they are being kidnapped effectively to be a plaything for the king. Her life that's been so hard has just gotten worse. Because here's how the contest works, just so you understand everything that she's dealing with. Right, so young ladies throughout the kingdom are gathered. And we don't know how many are gathered. We're pretty sure it's at least a few hundred girls. It could possibly have been thousands. Because if we look at the information that we have, the contest may have lasted up to 4 years. And this whole time, they're bringing girls back in. Now, when a girl comes in, keep in mind, this would have been a vast palace. When they come in, they get a year of preparation. That includes beauty treatments, behavioral training, all those sort of things. And then after that 1 year of preparation, they have their chance to prove to the king that they should be queen. And how much time do they get to prove that they should be queen? I'll wait. One night. You get one night. So in case you were wondering what kind of contest this is, it just got clear. Right? Now the question might be that, well, if you don't want to do this, if you don't want to be queen, just when you get there, do a bad job. Right? Right? Why not? Well, here's the deal. Once you've been brought in, and anyone who spent time with the king can never go home. Because you can't have someone who's been with the king be out with anyone else after that. So every one of these girls are taken knowing they will never go back home. If you do get chosen, you will be queen. If you are not chosen, you will be put off in a far off part of the palace. You will never see the king again. You will never see your family again. You will have food and shelter, but you will be locked away, effectively as a prisoner, for the rest of your life. That's the facts for Esther. That's the reality of her situation. There is no version of this where she gets what she wants, just wanting to go back home. That is not an option. So what she is facing is that option. What do I do? Well, again, let's think about Esther's life. Right, Esther has had, you know, we only know some of the difficulties in her life, right? Again, that she's under a conquered nation. Her parents died when she was young. She's being raised by her cousin. Odds are her cousin did not have much money, so she probably was raised somewhat poor. And the good news is that she's not a person who expects life to be easy. That she's a person who recognizes that in difficult situations, you have to rise up and do what it takes. Now, again, the Bible does not specifically say that, those words I just said, that someone who rises up and do what it takes, but she does. And I think that's one of the things that we want to remember is that I think all of us wish our lives were easier. Right? Some of our lives have been much harder than others, but all of us have had things, and we wish our lives were easier. But it's how we deal with the difficult things. It's our willingness to deal with the difficult things that prepare us, that give us abilities, that allow us to, when the next difficult thing comes along, know better how to deal with it. And I truly believe it was the difficulties that Esther had been through in her life that empowered her to say that, okay, this is another difficult situation, and there is no outcome I like here. So I'm going to do what it takes. And that's what she does. She actually recognizes that I need to do what it takes. Because again, the facts of her situation are she is never going back home. She accepts that reality. It's not her fault. She cannot control that fact. It's out of her control. We know she has faith because we'll see throughout the narrative that she leans on God. But she also chooses to fight. She chooses to do what she can to be successful. She understands what she cannot control. She surrenders that to God. She understands what she can, and she chooses to try to succeed. And one of the things we see in Esther's narrative is that God does appear to be at work in her experience. Because as soon as she arrives at the palace, she actually meets the servant that's in charge of the whole deal, the guy who's over the entire contest. And that servant actually takes a liking to her. So he actually gives her special treatment. He actually gives her better food than the other girls get. He gives her better cosmetics. He actually assigns her the best attendants in the palace. And he even agrees to personally advise her in this experience. None of those are things that she could control. So God clearly appears to be at work. But then what are the things that she can control? Well, she could just kind of pout and say, well, I don't want to deal with this. Or she could look around and see what are the opportunities that she can capitalize on. Well, one of the things we find is that she's willing to listen to people that she trusts, effectively take wise counsel. And we actually see two explicit examples of that in her narrative. One of the examples comes from her cousin Mordecai, because it says, Esther had not told anyone of her nationality and family background because Mordecai had directed her not to do so. So she didn't say what her nationality was. Why is that important? Well, this is the kingdom of Persia. The kingdom of Persia would have generally preferred to have a queen who was Persian, and she wasn't. And the thing is, I want to be clear here, this is not suggesting that the way that we succeed is by lying about who we are. That's not what's happening here. But at the same time, if you walk into a job interview, do you want to tell a person your entire life history and all the mistakes you've made and all the things you've done wrong? Stay focused, right? Telling people her nationality in this scenario had nothing to do with it. And what it allowed her to do was be judged for who she is. Right, that people would have actually made preconceived notions. Right, like I have many friends who are alcoholics and recovering addicts, and they don't walk into job interviews going, "Yep, been sober for 6 months." Right, don't be ashamed of where you've been, but just don't do it. There are places to talk about, there are places to not. It's the same situation, right? So she put herself in the best possible position by listening to what Mordecai had told her. But also, she listens to advice from the servant in charge. Because the servant in charge tells her this. Or actually, we're told this. When it was Esther's turn to go to the king, she accepted the advice of the servant in charge. She asked for nothing except what he suggested, and she was admired by everyone who saw her. So the servant in charge gave her some advice. He told her what to wear. Now, why is that important? Well, keep in mind that most of the girls who were involved in this contest would not have really been used to being around a palace. In fact, it's very unlikely that any noble's daughters were taken, right? So it would have been much more common people. And so the richness and glitter of the palace would have been very appealing, right? So as each girl got her turn, they got the chance to go into this part of the palace where there is endless selections of wardrobe, endless selections of jewelry, some of the most valuable things you can imagine, cosmetics. Odds are that most of those girls trying to glam themselves up would have picked very, very, potentially gaudy clothing, lots of jewelry, lots of makeup. And although for them this was special, King sees that stuff all the time. So clearly what the advisor told her was, you're already beautiful. Yeah, maybe a little bit of jewelry, a little bit of makeup, but you be you. And that's the thing I want you to hear, is that when you're dealing with difficult things, you're going to be tempted to try to be something else, to try to mask parts of yourself, to try to mask who you are, to be unconfident about who you are. You be you. You are not an accident. Your life is not an accident. You are not an accident. When you are in a difficult situation, God has put you together for this moment. Right, all those difficult things you went through, all those things you experienced. Getting back to, we don't blurt out all of our history, but recognize that those things are part of the building blocks of who you are. And it's not a surprise to God that you're there in whatever moment you're dealing with. Trust that. Make that fundamental to you, how you deal with the difficulties in your life. And as it comes to Esther, as she goes in, and she goes and talks to the king. The narrative tells us. And the king loved Esther more than any of the other young women. He was so delighted with her that he set the royal crown on her head and declared her queen instead of Vashti. Because of the way she approaches the issue, she becomes queen. And not only does she become queen, but she also, because of her position, again, she doesn't have authority, but she has position, she has privilege. She's actually able to even help her cousin Mordecai. She's actually able to get him a position, kind of a job, near the palace. So where normally someone who got that position of queen would never see their family again, she's able to use her position, again, showing that she's resourceful. She's able to use her position to actually get him a job where he's actually near the palace all the time. So she actually improves his life as well. And the thing that I want to really reinforce here is, right, that, this is not a nice story. It's kind of funny. If it wasn't in the Bible, I would never tell this story on a Sunday morning sort of thing. But I think it's something that God wants to show us. That life is hard. You face things you don't want. You are in situations sometimes where there is no outcome available that's what you wanted. And Esther shows us what to do with this, right? In Esther's case, right, none of this is her fault. But it's where she is. But she faced the facts of her situation. She faced the reality of her situation. And she addressed it. She shows how important it is to fight, to do what you can, to control the things that you can control. And she also shows us the power of faith, of leaning on God, trusting that God will bring the story together. And now here's the thing. After all Esther has gone through in the past 40 minutes, her story is just getting started. The difficulties that she will face will get harder as time goes on. And the stakes will actually get higher, as hard as that is to imagine. And as we go through the weeks ahead, talking about the story of Esther, we will see she follows this same pattern over and over again. And I want you to consider that same thing, to be confident in who you are, confident that God is with you, confident that God has a plan for all the pain that you've experienced and all the loss that you've experienced. And don't be ashamed of it. Recognize what it's taught you and use it to do the work that God calls you to.